speaker is George Murphy. George got a PhD from Johns Hopkins in physics and an MDiv from Wartburg Seminary. He's a pastoral associate, and he is at Trinity Lutheran Seminary, now retired, I understand, okay. And George will be talking to us about cosmological presuppositions.
Though I know from pastoral experience it may be fruitless, I would encourage people to move forward because we don't have microphones.
Yes, let's speak.
So that would be helpful, and I will try to use my Prediger tone, as my mother said. Scientists develop their theories from a variety of initial presuppositions. Einstein argued that the fundamental principles of a physical theory are not found by induction from empirical data, but are free inventions of the human intellect. And even less are metaphysical beliefs, including our religious ones, based simply on experience of the world. Philosophical or religious beliefs may play important roles in the development of cosmological theories, especially when some of those theories are quite speculative. Scientific cosmology is much more than just astrophysics on a large scale. Carl Sagan's claim that the cosmos is all that is or ever was or ever will be illustrates the influence that our total world views can have on our cosmologies. But on the other hand, the fact that we don't like a scientist's metaphysical presuppositions does not mean that his or her theory is wrong. Perhaps equally important here is the fact that the religious or perhaps anti-religious assumptions of people in the general public who hear about cosmological theories can influence them on whether or not they see, for example, Big Bang cosmology as supportive of the Christian doctrine of creation, which some do, or as supportive of atheism, which some others do. And that's going to depend to a large extent on the kind of understanding that people have of what the Christian doctrine of creation is. I'm going to discuss three historical examples involving pantheism, Christianity, and atheism. And I'm having a little trouble with my stopwatch, so maybe I'll have to depend on your time. And then I will talk about the important so what question, and look briefly at some presuppositions in current cosmological theories. Well, first of all, when Einstein began in 1917 to apply general relativity to cosmology, it was commonly accepted that the universe in its overall aspect was unchanging. And it's not obvious why that should have been the case. We knew for a long time that the stars were moving around, that a large collection of material couldn't be stable under the influence just of gravitational forces. But Einstein did assume a static universe. His main concern was really here to express Mach's principle. That is, the idea that the inertia of bodies was due to other matter in the universe. And with a static universe, the only solution of his equations was just empty space in which there is no other matter. So that was a problem. So Einstein added to his equations a cosmological term, which represents a repulsive force at great distances that can cancel out or balance out the ordinary attractive gravitational force and make a static universe possible. And Einstein found then the result was a closed three-dimensional space, like the surface of a four-dimensional sphere, whose radius and density and the size of the cosmological term would determine, would all be related. Space was finite, but it had no boundary, so that no boundary conditions at infinity were necessary. Now, why did Einstein assume a static universe? It was conventional wisdom, but Einstein was not a person who always succumbed to conventional views of things. And as we know, if he'd approached the problem without that assumption, he might have predicted the expansion of the universe before it was observational evidence for it. One answer to that why question has been given by Max Jammer, a physicist and philosopher who was a friend of Einstein's and who wrote the book, quite a good book, Einstein on Religion. Einstein identified his religion many times with Spinoza's pantheism, in which God, who is immutable, can be identified with the divine attributes, including, quote, an extended thing like space. And so Jammer suggested Einstein identified the unchanging God with the unchanging universe. Now, Einstein initially rejected Alexander Friedman's non-static solution of the field equations simply by overlooking a simple calculational error. And that suggests that Einstein really did have some investment in a static model. Scientists usually don't express their religious motivations, especially when their theories turn out not to be right, so Einstein said nothing about that. But I think Jammer's suggestion is plausible. The influence of Spinoza on Einstein is also very consistent with Einstein's belief in determinism and his denial of free will. I think it's interesting that today's young Earth creationists also believe that God created a perfect, unchanging, static world before this so-called fall. And in fact, one of them, Robert Gentry, has tried to adapt Einstein's static solution in order to work out so it's consistent with six-day creation. Now, as we know, at about the same time that Einstein was doing this work, astronomers were discovering the extragalactic nature of the spiral nebulae and discovering the redshifts in their light spectra. And a few years after this, several people, Friedman, de Sitter, Lemaître, found expanding solutions of Einstein's equations. And then Hubble found the relationship between redshifts and distances of galaxies that are actually consistent with those solutions, because in general relativity, as space expands, light waves in transit are expanded along with it, which accounts for the redshift. And so because of these discoveries, Einstein renounced the cosmological constant. But as we will see later, that's not the end of the story. Now, the British astrophysicist Milne took a very different approach. He said, let's consider a sphere of non-interacting particles that are all in a very small space to begin with. And they have a distribution of velocities ranging from zero to the speed of light. Well, the ones that are moving outward are all going to continue to move outward. The ones that are moving inward will eventually pass the origin and start moving outward. And eventually, you'll have an expanding sphere of particles that can be thought of as representing the galaxies. And the light emitted by one and traveling to another will be redshifted, this time because of the Doppler shift. Now, at first, that seems to suggest a unique center of cosmic expansion. But as Milne pointed out, if the ones at the fastest ones are moving at the speed of light, they're equivalent to a light wave moving out from the center. And we know from relativity that every one of those who has been present at the beginning of the expansion is going to consider him or herself as being at the center of the expansion. And in fact, you can show in more detail that an observer on every particle will see that particle as being at the center of a uniform expansion. And so Milne saw this as giving a model of the universe of galaxies. And Milne went on to develop his own model of the universe, this that I've just sketched, and his own version of special relativity that he called kinematic relativity. He didn't accept the general theory. And while his model is quite different from Big Bang models based on general relativity, it has the same property as of having a unique temporal origin. Milne's last book, that is titled Modern Cosmology and the Christian Idea of God is significant. Because near the beginning, he says, to say that the universe is rational is to say that its creator is rational. Thus, one cannot avoid the position that one's religious beliefs must color and control one's attitude to science and scientific hypothesis. And that makes it seem likely that Milne's understanding, Milne's religious beliefs, had perhaps some influence, at least were present there, when Milne formulated his cosmological model. And that feeling is strengthened by the fact that at the very end of this book, Milne says that, I was brought up as both a physicist and a member of the Church of England, and though I've had my periods of agnosticism, I've always recovered from them, and I do most firmly believe that this universe was created by Almighty God. So it's very distinctly a religious component of Milne's beliefs here. Now, it would be superfluous to note all the people who have seen a connection between these Big Bang type models and the Christian concept of the temporal origin of the universe and of creation. But I'll comment on that after a little while. But first I want to look at a third very different example. Back in the 1930s and 1940s, cosmology had a very serious timescale problem because the value of the time from the beginning of expansion, which could be determined from Hubble's data, gave a time of about 2 billion years back to the beginning of expansion. And even at that time, we knew that the Earth was significantly older than that. So how can the Earth be older than the universe? There were two forms of a radical solution to that problem that were presented by Bondi and Gold and also by Fred Hoyle in their steady state model of the universe, where there is no beginning of cosmic expansion. Universe has always been and always will be expanding and continue to look the same on an overall scale because new matter is continually being created. And this time scale problem could then be taken care of by simply saying, well, our galaxy happens to be simply somewhat older than the average age of galaxies. So, okay. Bondi and Gold based their model on a so-called perfect cosmological principle. That is, that the universe would look the same to an observer not only at any place in the universe, but at any time, again, averaged over sufficiently large scales. And they didn't really explain how the matter could originate, how it could be created. It simply had to in order to keep the universe always looking the same. Hoyle, on the other hand, developed a rather different version of this in which he added a so-called creation field term to Einstein's equations and, again, came out with the same kind of solution that Bondi and Gold had. Now, I have not been able to find out anything about Gold's religious views, but those of Bondi and Hoyle were definitely antagonistic to religion. Bondi was involved throughout his life in atheistic and secular humanism causes. Hoyle was rather sarcastic, both about religious beliefs and, interestingly, about materialism. But in any case, one might easily get the conclusion, and some people have drawn this conclusion, that they developed this theory in order to get rid of what looked disturbingly like a moment of creation. But as I pointed out, while they may well have been happy with that result, but the fact is there really was a serious problem that had to be solved, that problem of the timescale, and their model solved it. And it agreed with observations that existed at that time. Moreover, it pushed physicists to develop what are now our current theories of how the heavy elements were formed, because they didn't have any initial hot, dense state in which you could try to get the heavy elements formed. So you had to do it in the interior of stars, and we know now that that's the way it happened. Now, the timescale problem was eventually solved by better measures of galactic distances. And by the 1960s, quasars and then the microwave background retired the steady state theory to the History of Science Museum. But nevertheless, it was a good theory while it lasted. I liked it when I read Fred Hoyle's book. I never really thought very hard about how to reconcile that with Christianity when I was in junior high school, but that's another matter. Now, certainly you can see you could see the steady state model as contradicting the Christian doctrine of creation. You can also, though, simply interpret the continuous creation of matter as God's continuing creative activity and see the universe as continually existing in dependence upon God. Now, for completeness here, I think we should consider presuppositions that both religious and non-religious people have about belief in creation. Now, we'll look at three issues here. First of all, there is very strong evidence now that the universe did have, in some sense, a temporal beginning about 14 billion years ago in the hot, dense state. You all know the song, probably. Back in 1978, after the microwave background discovery, the astronomer Robert Jastrow, who described himself as a religious agnostic, put it this way in terms of this little parable. For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. And as he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. Now, some Christians probably were sort of gleeful about that. Serious theologians are more careful. Georges Lemaître, who developed some of the early models of the expanding universe and a sort of precursor of the Big Bang with his theory or his model of the primeval atom, was not happy when Pope Pius XII endorsed such theories as confirmation and vindication of the Christian doctrine of creation. He didn't think you could move that easily from the experimental evidence to the theological claim. Now, the classic Big Bang picture is certainly consistent with belief in divine creation and with a traditional picture of in the beginning. It's another matter to say that it proves that picture. St. Thomas Aquinas said that we could know by reason that God created the universe. We could argue about that, but okay, that's one claim. But Aquinas then went on to say that the universe had a temporal origin, we know only by revelation. And I think, though, there's a little bit of question about that, because on the one hand, to say that we know that the universe had an origin in time depends to some extent on how we translate the first verse of Genesis. Is it in the beginning God created, or in the beginning when God created? You know, the differences in translation that you see in different versions. Secondly, it depends on your genre, your understanding of the genre of the whole Genesis creation account. So there are some presuppositions there. The traditional Christian view does say that all things were created by God. I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, of all that is, visible and invisible. And it is easier to understand that if the universe did have a temporal origin. That does not mean that God created the universe in time, but with time, known in tempore sed cum tempore, St. Augustine said. However, it is possible, but you're pushing the creedal boundaries, to say that the universe has always existed and has always depended fundamentally on God. I'm going to skip over the problem I'll just note that Milne's belief that God had to create the universe this way to be inconsistent with theory of relativity is problematic because it denies the contingency of creation. Third point I have to note is that there is unfortunate ignorance about what the Christian doctrine of creation means on the part of some scientists and atheists. The best example is Lawrence Krauss's book, A Universe from Nothing, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing. I wrote a review of this for Perspectives a few years ago. Krauss's book, in many ways, is quite good. It's a good treatment of some aspects of cosmology. But his claim that science can explain creatio ex nihilo is simply a bait and switch. Because the argument is basically, the quantum vacuum is not nothing. And particles can emerge from the quantum vacuum, and therefore particles can emerge from nothing. You know, and it's obviously shaky if you just think about what the words mean. It's true that particles, massive particles, can emerge from a state of net state of zero energy when you take into account relativity and quantum theory and the existence of gravitation. But again, the quantum vacuum isn't nothing. Stephen Hawking has made a similar mistake. I had hoped to say a little bit more about the checkered history of Einstein's cosmological constant, and I am running out of time, obviously, and I hope to do further work on this. I will just say that there has been a great deal of prejudice against the cosmological constant, and cosmologists were forced to admit it, at least as a temporary stopgap, when the accelerated expansion of the universe was discovered about 20 years ago. And I think there are some very good reasons for taking the cosmological term in Einstein's equations more seriously, but I will have to stop there.
All right, thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Yeah.
Just a personal story that might be of interest. When I was an undergraduate at Cambridge University, one of my tutors was Jen Nalika, who was a co-worker with Fred Hoyle on the steady state theory of the universe. And I once asked him, as a wet behind the ears undergraduate, why do you believe that? And the answer he gave me was this perfect uniformity of space and of time.
Right, yes, the perfect cosmological principle.
Exactly.
Yes. Paul, bringing things a little up to date with some of the newer cosmologists like Guth and Tegmark and Linde, Tegmark characterizes the inflation as the gift that keeps on giving, because that's in effect doing the same thing that Hoyle's mechanism did by generating a continuous new series of inflationary universes forever.
Yes, the inflationary theory and eternal inflation and multiverses and so forth all have some similarities with that, some aspects of steady-state theory. And, you know, quite frankly, I think there's, as you get more and more into these theories, you get more and more speculative there. And I think there's more and more room for people's metaphysical presuppositions to play a role.
Were you convinced that the cosmological constant had to be non-zero because you associated it with a vacuum energy?
The vacuum energy gives a monstrous cosmological constant, something that came to 20-some powers too large. The interesting thing about a pure general relativity cosmological constant is that, among other things, that might balance out the effective cosmological constant from the vacuum energy. So that's one rather speculative possibility. Now, there are extensions of general relativity, I think particularly in Schrödinger's affine field theory that he developed back in the 1940s, that require a cosmological constant. It's not an option. It can't be zero. And so, you know, there's a possibility of maybe combining those things.
In apologetics, William Lane Craig finds a lot of value in Big Bang theory, and I think it's Billington's arguments about there having to have been an origin of time, and that is some kind of confirmation of Christian presuppositions. What do you think about William Lane Craig's treatments of cosmology?
To be honest with you, I'm not familiar enough with them to really be able to comment in detail.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I ask a second question?
Yeah.
Then what would you think about someone who used an apologetics argument that the cosmological constant that turns out to be 10 to the 120th power smaller than what general arguments would suggest?
What Von Thiel here suggests, yeah.
Is that a valid fine-tuning argument in your opinion?
I don't really see how that would work. I suppose if you really wanted to try to force it into a kind of fine-tuning thing, you might be able to do that. But I don't really see it having the, even though I like some of the theories, I don't see that as having much apologetic value. I think God has created a universe that looks an awful lot as if it could bring itself into existence. You know, that is the universe. I'm going to start my theology lecture. the fact that that we go all the way back toward the Big Bang, you know, we can explain things very well all the way back to, but we can't explain where the whole thing came from.
I have a question, actually. It seems that the presuppositions of scientists when they create their theories doesn't negate the validity of the theory.
No,
because
no.
It can be proven by data. It comes out in the mathematics, like the cosmological constant was put in there by Einstein, but he didn't like it because the mathematics required it.
Einstein didn't say this was my greatest blunder until he found out that the universe was expanding.
Yes. Yeah.
And in fact, a thing seldom noted on that. A few years after, and this is in Einstein's old book, The Meaning of Relativity, his lectures at Princeton, Einstein actually gives a possible, in his model, a possible explanation of where the cosmological constant comes from that really kind of in terms of classical electrodynamics sort of corresponds to some things in quantum field theory. So Einstein tried to propose a later model, and Einstein never said anything more about that. So it seems like he was kind of embarrassed about the whole thing.
Yeah, but the point is that the scientific method helps to iron out the problems associated with presuppositions of the scientists. But I wonder, too, as I study early church history, that I can see that components of our creed are defined by people who have very specific presuppositions in their theology based on what they experienced at the time or where they grew up. And we don't have anything there to self-correct the Christian model. And I'm wondering what your thoughts on that.
I don't know that one could really argue that there's anything in the ecumenical creeds that really stems from specific assumptions about the physical world. I mean, it's the creeds are basically a development of we know God in Jesus Christ, and we know the relationship between God and the one he called Father and their spirit, and it's a working out of all of that. And certainly there's some metaphysical presuppositions that go into the way they express those things. Mm-hmm. But I'd be hard-pressed to think of something about an ancient understanding of the physical world that led to a particular aspect of the creeds. Maybe you've got an example.
Just some ideas, and I don't know whether they're valid, but, I think about how the early church fathers and things were influenced perhaps by what the Neoplatonism and how you have sin is involved in the soul of God and therefore it had to be mixed and some ideas about So, yeah, these are just my ideas, but they aren't something that I've read. And
yeah.
So I wonder if Neoplatonism hasn't influenced some of our concepts of early Christianity.
Oh, it certainly certainly influences the theology of some of the church fathers.
Mm-hmm.
No question about that.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of, particularly Augustine's, even his early Christian writings, he's more of a Platonist than
yes.
he's a Christian.
But
but I'm talking simply about, like, the apostles in the Nicene Creed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it'd be like, now, you know, he came down from heaven in the Nicene Creed. I mean, clearly there's a sort of picture from, you know, a different picture of the world. So, you know,
so you think their presuppositions of how they express their thoughts don't necessarily affect the Christian viewpoint? And
what I'm saying simply is there is influence of some of the things you're talking about. I mean, the whole Hellenistic, views of Hellenistic philosophy,
mm-hmm.
Influence on the thinking of the church fathers, no question. And some of those, they said, no, we have to change these things. But I'm saying in the kind of core beliefs as they are expressed in the creeds, I don't see much influence. There may be some philosophical influence there. I don't really see much influence from their understanding of the nature of the physical world.
Okay. Yeah. All right, let's thank our speaker again.